Good morning, Reading. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to my show, Positively Healthy. Another beautiful day in paradise here in Shasta County. Boy, you know, we have the guest of all guests here again today. We have Ted Dawson, a primitive skills teacher, and, you know, part of my inspiration to have Ted on today is that, you know, as we move forward and we get more into technology and computers, we just need to look back and look at some of these skills of yesterday and some of the skills that I think we're starting to lose. You know, as I watch generations, a little bit of generational turnover here, I see all sorts of things that we used to know, people we used to be able to rely on for things, for knowledge, and it seems to me like we're losing a little bit of that. And so part of my inspiration today to bring Ted on, I just met Ted recently, and Ted, on his business card, it says primitive skills teacher. He lives in Shingletown, and it says practice your primitive skills the way your ancestors do. And Ted has a history of teaching fire making, certain types of rope and fishing line he makes. He is an expert in trapping and hide tanning, in shelter building, in the wild crafting of native plants and identifying our local plants around here, in native philosophy, and he is Wintu, even though he looks like a surfer, and he's a custom knife maker. He makes jewelry and wooden bowls. And welcome, Ted.
Thank you. It's a beautiful day to be here.
It is. Well, gosh. Well, let's start with the fact that, you know, what is a primitive skills teacher?
It's somebody that remembers how we used to live. I'm Narelmuk Wintu. My grandmother came from Trinity County, Junction City. And one of the things that's interesting about her is that a lot of people want to be a son of a chief or they want to be the son of a medicine man. My grandmother was just one of the Indians. So I'm descendant of just one of the Indians.
Well, hey, you're like the rest of us. We're just from somebody. We're from somewhere. Well, that's great. So then part of your understanding of your ancestors is trying to hold on to this knowledge? Okay.
Yes, my grandmother was a craftsman. She made baskets and rope and cordage, and that was her position with the tribe.
And then when is it that you realized maybe you should start teaching this?
I was doing a sweat lodge ceremony many, many years ago, and several times songs would come to me and stories would come to me, and I didn't know where they came from. And so I returned home to find out who I was. I was 34 years old at the time.
And then you decided through that experience that there were things, that there's just information that you have that you need to maybe develop more and then pass on?
Yes. My grandmother, or my great-grandmother, until the time I was 11, she told me who I was, and then when she passed, there was nobody. So I lived my, I guess, European heritage until I returned home. But until I was 11, my great-grandmother taught me who I was, took me out and showed me places, spoke the Wintu language, and taught me what was going on here.
Well, today you have a stack of books about plants. You've brought in pieces of plant. I see a beautiful knife that you're telling us that you've made. It's just extraordinary. And so let's start with the plants right there. I mean, that we have two types of plants. One is a root, and one I don't have a history of knowing this plant. So let's have you start here with just, we have a minute before a break, and just kind of give our audience a little bit of a background with you know, of this plant.
Okay, this is called Princess Pine. In the books, it's called Pipsissewa, and it will rebuild your body from stuff that we've done to it. It will go into your kidneys and flush out the uric acid and the other toxins in your body, because if those toxins are in your body, your body's going to be toxic. It does other things with the kidneys, and it does things with the spleen and several other organs, but it's a wonderful plant. And several years ago, people used to use it for making root beer and other drinks.
That sounds very all-purpose. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about that plant a little more and then how you actually turn it into medicine. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy. We'll be right back.
Slow down, you move too fast.
Welcome back. You're listening to Positively Healthy, and I'm Dr. Trudy Pratt, and we're talking with Ted Dawson, our primitive skills teacher today. Welcome back, Ted.
Yeah.
Well, you know, here in the studio, we've got this big piece of plant, and it's a nice-looking piece of plant, kind of a rich green with soft leaves, and I can't say that it's really anything I've seen before. You're telling us that it's at about the elevation of 3,500 feet? Okay, so that's really, that's higher than Shingletown, right? So where did you find that thing?
I found it in my backyard.
Oh, okay.
Up in the mountains.
Up in the mountains, okay.
It grows all over the place. It's on the list of plants to watch, which means that they don't really want you just going out and harvesting bunches of it, because people did that, and they devastated it. But in the last 20 years that I've been using it, it was kind of waiting for somebody to bring it back in. And 20 years ago, there was hardly any of it. Now I can walk in my backyard and step over just tons and tons of it all over the place.
Very beautiful looking. It looks like it probably is, almost ornamental in its its look. So now, it's when it becomes medicine, you were saying at the break that you know, you're basically putting it in water and making a tea. And I, of course, my brain goes to square tea bag dried leaves, and that isn't where my brain should go. You would put that in water just like that in a big, maybe a couple of quart stainless steel container of water. Is that what you'd do?
I actually like glass better than stainless steel, because stainless steel still has metals in it, and even though it's pure and clean, it doesn't leach. Glass doesn't have anything that leaches in, so I like making tea out of glass. And the way you make tea is you chop this up, chop the leaves and the root and everything of this, and you might take, a tablespoon of chopped leaves and root and boil some water. When the water has taken to a boil, you turn it off, put the leaves in there, and a tablespoon for a cup of water, and let it cool down. When it's cooled down to drink, it's ready to drink.
And then how much would someone drink in a day if they just want to be healthier? They're not really fighting a disease or disorder. They're just thinking, hey, I want to be a little cleaned out and, you know, a little spring cleaning.
I would drink it instead of a cup of coffee in the morning. In the evening, I would drink one cup of it before I go to bed to relax you, because it will mellow you out, and it's pleasant. Pleasant tasting, and if some people don't like it, they can put a little bit of honey in there.
It smells good. I mean, it doesn't have an offensive presentation. And then tell us then also about your root that you brought.
The tincture.
Oh, the tincture. Thank you. Yeah, it can also be in a tincture. So tell us what a tincture is for those folks just kind of new to herbal medicine.
Okay. A tincture, I use 190 proof pure grape alcohol because it's pure, it's clean, it tastes good. And once you get the medicine out of the plant, the alcohol dissipates and it doesn't bother you. If you're sensitive to alcohol, 190 proof pure grape is the stuff to use. Amateurs use vodka. Amateurs use brandy. I hope I didn't offend anybody there.
Not in this room.
But anyway, I take a tincture and it's a 5-to-1. I'll say one cup of the root, 5 cups of alcohol.
And then once something is preserved in alcohol, it's basically a medicine that and it's going to last kind of indefinitely, or what's your timeline for that?
I'll put them in amber jars and put them in the cupboard. Don't put them on the counter to let the sun get to them, because that will the ultraviolet rays will dissipate the potency.
Okay, it starts to break down.
Yeah.
Okay, so then so if someone were to make some, say, a bunch of that this year, they can have that for 5 years? What are you comfortable sort of deciding how long it would last?
Okay, when you take a tincture or any medicine, as far as I'm concerned, there's biorhythms. And if you take a medicine for 21 days, then you need to lay off of it for 7 days, regardless, just to see how your body does with it, and your body has to heal itself. So you have to take a break. I would take no medicine at all any further than 21 days.
Okay, that's great.
And when you make a tincture out of that, you put it in the alcohol and let it sit there for 30 days before you can get the medicine out.
Okay, so all of the good ingredients have to then come out into the alcohol.
Yes.
Okay, and what is the root that you brought today?
It's called, in the Wintu language, it's called chuachi. And it's another name is wild celery root. The Karuk people call it kishwuf. It's Lomation californicum, if you're a botanist.
That's how I know it, yeah.
But it's used for cooking, and when it's dug for cooking, the women can go out, and I'm a Wintu, and people originally called us diggers because they saw us digging roots. The word digger is really a derogatory term. It's like calling somebody a nigger or something like that. It's rude. You don't call people that. So even though this is a root and I was digging it, don't call me a digger Indian, please.
Okay.
And the root, if somebody's chronically sick and has something that's systemically in their body, this will cleanse it out. If there's something that's in their body that just won't heal, this will support the immune system and rebuild the body so that it regrows itself. Organs get destroyed, and this will help. It won't regrow organs. It will help the immune system and the body regrow organs.
Okay. And, you know, we have our guest host with us today, Mark Beecham. Mark, do you have some questions you wanted to ask?
Yes. I see the root. I see what the root looks like. But what does the plant look like if I were out in the and where would I find the plant?
I can't tell you that. You're not a medicine person.
Oh. So I have to pay you.
Yeah. You have to pay me. It's got yellow flowers, and it's no higher than your knees.
There you go. You're on your own, Mark. That's all you need to know.
Would I find it around Reading, or would I have
no.
to come up to Shingletown?
No.
No, no, okay.
It's a very sacred plant, and I actually have only taken one other person besides my son to dig it. So given the location, I can't do that. My tribal elders would get upset with me. There's some over in Trinity County.
Okay.
There's some up in Siskiyou County, up in the Marbles. There's up there. Yeah, over by Hay Fork, there's some.
I'll go there this afternoon.
Oh, so we're looking at a root. Now, how do you prepare a root then?
Okay, well, this afternoon I'm going to a sweat lodge ceremony. And in the sweat lodge, you powder this up, and then you put this on the stones, and when the door is closed, and you breathe the fumes.
Oh, okay.
And it goes into your lungs, and if there's metals or toxic things in your lungs, this will go into your lungs, grab hold of those, and when you exhale, it will cleanse your lungs out.
Wow, okay, impressive. Well, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. We're going to take a quick radio break here, and you're listening to Positively Healthy on KCNR. We'll be right back.
You move too fast.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and you're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR. And in the studio, we have Ted Dawson, a primitive skills teacher, with us today. And we've talked about two plant extracts to get you healthy. And we're going to move on now. Ted also, you know, he makes these beautiful knives, and he has one here in the studio. And the handle is made of... root of manzanita? Okay. And so so tell us about this knife.
Okay. I started making knives probably about 30 years ago, and I was making them out of stainless steel. And I would go to camp and go using them, and, yeah, they would hold a nice edge, but when I started making them commercially, half the people couldn't sharpen them or would break them. And so I'm like, my... Dad gave me the family forge that had been in the family 150 years, and I found out about coil springs. And since I didn't have to buy it, and people gave me old coil springs, it's a steel called 5160. It's a high-carbon steel. It will oxidize, but you can sharpen it, and it holds an edge. And this last year, when I went buffalo hunting, I took my knife, and I dressed out the buffalo, quartered the buffalo, took the heart out, took a bite out of it, because that's part of the ceremony, and never had to sharpen that knife. So that's a really good sharp knife.
Wow. Okay. And then what's the handle made
of? Okay, the reason I put manzanita burl on the handle is because it's really, really tough, hard stuff. And there's 25 different varieties of manzanita in the area. And there's only one that has a burl like this. And
it's beautiful.
It's beautiful stuff. And I put tongue oil on it. And the reason I put tongue oil on it is because it keeps the handle nice and pretty. Plus, if you get it wet or bloody or messy, you can just wash it off and it'll stick to the hand. It won't be slippery. Sometimes when people are cutting vegetables, they get their knife wet. My knives will stick in your hand.
And those grooves look like they're perfectly, when I grabbed it, I mean, no matter what your hand is like, it's a nice grip. You've grooved that out beautifully, if those are the words.
Yeah.
whatever you've done there, it's quite nice.
Well,
how much does a knife like that, how much do you sell a knife like that for?
Okay, well, this one is a lighter duty knife, and it's the blade itself, the steel is an eighth inch thick, and it's smaller. This one sells for $200. If I put turquoise or malachite or fossil walrus ivory, woolly mammoth ivory, it costs a little more. My bigger knives that have a guard on them, a steel guard up here front and in front of the cutting blade, they sell for about $300, and they're thicker. They're 3/16 of an inch thick.
So it'd be a present for someone really special that would last a lifetime, basically.
I tell people, if you break it, it's because you are doing something that you shouldn't have been doing, because I've used a knife for years and never broken one. They will hold an edge, and you should be able to give that down to your children.
How many hours do you think you have into making that knife?
Oh, 12 to 15.
Wow, it looks like it.
And with the sheath has a pin in there. So when you put the knife in and close the pin down, the knife cannot come out, so you can't lose it. You can shake the sheath upside down, and the knife will stay there.
Where do you sell these knives, and how can people get a hold of you?
They can check out my email address or my website. My email address is wintuknives@frontiernet.net. It's wintuknives at frontiernet.net. We'll say that again a little later.
We'll go over that a couple of times. Well, that's okay. A beautiful knife, and
but
what a gift.
Yeah, I have a website, and it's the same. It's wintuknives.
Okay.
You mentioned something about there being many kinds of manzanita in the area, and you also mentioned during the break that there are lots and lots of different kinds of poison oak, and I'm sure that a lot of people are interested in that topic, being that it's spring and people are out and about, and this is poison oak season. So what can you tell people about poison oak, and maybe how to avoid it, and what kind of wintu potions or whatever that might be used, poultices that might be used to prevent it?
Okay, a couple weeks ago I did an herbal walk at the Horsetown Preserve, Clear Creek, and we made some poison oak medicine there. We took some water from the creek, from Clear Creek, and set it on the counter and cut up some manzanita leaves. And it doesn't matter what kind of manzanita leaves you use, but the finer you cut them up, the better. And then you take some acorns and smash up. If you have a gallon of water, you want maybe a cup of manzanita leaves and about 2 cups of acorns. You throw that in the water, and the tannic acid in the water will come out, and it'll turn reddish, which that's a combination of reddish or brown.
I'm like, reddish, okay. That works for me.
And when it's a little reddish, you can take a washcloth and put it in there, get it all wet, put it on your poison oak, and it'll cool it down and lower the temperature, because your skin, when it gets warm, the oils start moving around, and that poison oak will start spreading. And if you can cool the temperature of your body down, you can get rid of it. And you don't want to drink that, because the tannic acid will pretty much loosen your entire system up.
We know what that means. Okay, well, that's an unbelievable tip. And so you're basically taking a cloth, a washcloth, and you're wiping your arm or whatever got exposed down. Okay.
Yeah. And there's several different kinds of poison oak. There's poison sumac. And the difference between poison sumac and poison oak is sumac grows up trees. It's a vine. And the stem of it is softer. that will literally burn holes in your skin. Nasty stuff. That black gooey stuff that comes out of there is very nasty, and everybody has problems with it. Regular poison oak you can avoid. Poison oak doesn't bother me.
Regular poison oak doesn't bother you?
No, I can roll in regular poison oak and it won't bother me.
So for someone out hiking around, they can, if they see it going up the tree,
yes,
be very, very, very careful.
Yes.
And then if you see it sprouting up out of the ground, it's a little more benign?
Well, there's a difference between being allergic and being toxic and being very sensitive. I'm sensitive. If I scratch my skin, poison oak will get in there and irritate me. As long as I don't scratch my skin, poison oak won't bother me.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break here, and this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. There's so much to learn about life. We'll be right back after this message. Hi.
Slow down, you move too fast.
Welcome back. You're listening to KCNR on 1460 AM. Clearly News Talk Radio. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and we have a guest today, Ted Dawson, who is a primitive skills teacher here in Shasta County. And Ted, where exactly are you teaching? I know schools have you do certain special programs. And
yes, Rod Lindsay runs the Title IX, or sometimes it's Title VII, depends on the year they change the funding for it and where the grants to pay us go. But I go to the schools, and I'll go like onto a high school campus and take a roadkill squirrel and hand a high school kid a knife and teach him to dress it out.
Oh my goodness, what's the response of the kids?
Most of the time, it's a young gal that wants to do it.
Is that right?
The high school guys are like, "Oh, that's yucky," but the girls, I have a lot of respect for them because they're like, "Wow, that's cool."
Huh.
And traditionally, that's what they did. The men would go out and kill and the women would process the food.
Okay.
So that's a traditional thing. But they love it when I'm on campus and I hand them a knife. And a dead squirrel.
Yeah, and a dead squirrel. Because
yeah.
It's just so different than what they're accustomed to.
A couple years ago when I was at Anderson High School, this young fellow, I was teaching him to make fire. And we were doing it with a stick, with a spindle. I use elderberry spindle on a cedar hearth. And this young man was doing it, and I thought it was so cool because he got to be on the news that night, on the 6 o'clock news.
Oh, wow.
I've been on the news, and people have seen me make fire, but I felt like it was my success to have this young man take this stick, make a coal, and then put it into this nest. It's like a bird's nest that he put it into, and they showed him blowing the coal, is what it's called, and he actually made fire and had it on TV, and I thought, yeah.
Oh, my. Hey, can you take us through that process a little bit? I mean, we've all seen it. We've tried it in sixth grade. I could never get anything to even warm up, you know. So can you maybe take us through what it really means to start a fire without a match?
Okay, well, one thing, if people come to me and they really want to learn all of this stuff seriously, everything that I talk about, these roots to dig, the plants to pick, the fire to make, the squirrel to process, the acorns to make, everything has a song. I don't teach that unless somebody comes and says, "Ted, would you teach me this?" I'm not allowed to go and put it over the air or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
when people make fire and they're having trouble, I'll come over to them and I'll say, "Are you serious about this?" And I'll sit there and I'll start singing, and they'll get fire. Because they don't realize that the song brings the medicine from the earth. And all of the medicine we have comes from the earth. I don't want to get too out there with that, but everything we need comes from the earth. All medicines traditionally came from plant medicines. But anyway, back to the fire. The elderberry spindle, I'll go and cut a piece that's maybe 2 feet long and about as big as your little finger around, and let it sit there for a year and wrap several of them up so that they dry in season. And then I'll get a cedar board that's maybe, three quarters of an inch thick, put a notch in there, and run the spindle back and forth with my hands between my two hands. And after a while, we'll get a nice fat coal. And the nest is the most important part, or the second important part. It's like, you know, in a bird's nest, there's all that nice, soft, fluffy stuff. Well, when you make a nest for a fire, you have to make all that nice, soft, fluffy stuff.
Okay.
Say that three times real fast.
I don't think I could.
Anyway, and then you put the coal in there, and you have to keep it together. And when you blow the coal and make the fire, you're holding fire in your hand, and it's really pretty cool. And then you put that down into the fire that's on the ground and get that going. And that's a whole nother thing. So there's three basic parts to making fire. You have to get the coal, you have to blow the flame in the nest, and then you have to get the fire on the ground going.
Okay, so I understand that we're creating friction. When you say the coal, what are you talking about? I understand that we're trying to get something to get hot mm-hmm. enough to spark into the fluffy stuff.
Every fire maker has their favorite, and the reason I like elderberry is because when I spin it in the cedar, it makes this powder, and it grinds away at the cedar, and the combination, and the elderberry grinds away too, and it's the two different woods together, and the way you notch it, it makes the coal pack together. A little bit of history about the Wind Two people and several of the other fire keepers is that when you want to be a firekeeper, you go to the elders and ask them if you want it to be an honorable position. Traditionally, you would have to keep the fire going for a full year. And if somebody wanted to take a fire back to their camp, they had to come and ask you to take a coal so that they can cook with it, because you were the firekeeper and they had to come to you. And the way the fire was kept going, it wasn't little sticks. They might get a log. Remember, they didn't have chainsaws back then.
Okay.
So they would have a long stick, and they would just keep shoving it into the fire in different directions to keep it going. If that fire ever went out in that year, it didn't matter whether it was raining, snowing, what the conditions were. You had to keep it going.
Well, a lot of pressure.
The fire had both, I guess, a spiritual as well as a practical application, correct?
Well, when you sleep next to the fire to keep it going, you have dreams, and there's a philosophy that your dreams are just another world, and your dreams are your teachers. And when you sleep next to a fire and keep it going, your dreams are really, really wonderful. Last summer, I was at a special site, and I did two presentations there. And the first time, I did my prayers in the morning and held my pipe and did my ceremony, and they told me I could have fire. So I went out, and I spun the stick, and the fire came up. A month later, I did my prayers and songs, and they told me I couldn't have fire. So I didn't even get my sticks out, because if they don't give you permission, that means it's unsafe. If it's unsafe, that means the fire could escape and cause problems. So before you do a fire, as far as I'm concerned, you always have to do a prayer.
Interesting. Gosh, we're learning so much today. Well, you know, we're going to take a quick radio break here, and you're listening to Dr. Trudy Pratt's Positively Healthy Show on KCNR 1460. We'll be right back with more of Ted Dawson right after this. Oh, welcome back. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt, and boy, during the break, we're hearing about this little pyros here in the studio. This fire thing, gosh, everybody seems to love fire. Well, welcome back. So, Ted, tell us a little bit more about manzanita.
The reason we work with manzanita is because it doesn't put out toxic smoke for people to be around. One of the things that people don't know about the original people is we died from a lot of lung problems because we were always around smoke. And when you're in your, it's called a halute, or your house, you burned to cook in there, and there was smoke all over the place. So a lot of people had lung and respiratory problems. Most of our lives were done outside, and we didn't sleep or do much inside our shelters except for just store things. And in inclement weather, we would sleep in there because we wimped out.
I wouldn't call it wimping out. Maybe you got smart.
But for the most part, manzanita was burned because it produced a hot, hot flame. And people have told me that they don't like burning it in their wood stove. I have no problem because I would put one piece in there. And when I go to bed at night, I'll throw a burl in there and let it smolder all night. And in the morning, I'll put the air on and my house will heat up. Manzanita doesn't make an awful lot of ashes. But when we do our ceremonial fires, a lot of times we start the fire with cedar wood. Cedar starts off fast, burns easy, and when it's the smoke, it smells good. Other woods, like oak, people burn oak in their wood stove, and then they have allergies to it, and they're not even knowing why they're having respiratory problems. Their lungs will get congested. Their sinuses will get congested. It's because they're burning oak wood.
You know, we're just trained to burn oak in this area. It's like, oh, it's oak. Oh, good. And we all order oak when we have firewood delivered. And so tell us more about the symptoms of oak.
Having to go see the doctor because you can't breathe because your nose is stuffed up.
Yeah.
Having a cough. Being congested. Not breathing well. Some people even get allergies on their skin, rashes, because there's smoke that comes into the house. And it might dry your skin out. And things like oak make such a nice hot fire that they'll dry your skin out. And when I make my salves, I sell more salve in the wintertime because people are indoors an awful lot, and the wood stoves especially will dry their skin out.
So your recommendation to someone who has a fireplace or a wood stove in our area in the winter is to burn basically cedar or cedar and manzanita? Would you just suggest both? Or?
Lodgepole is actually one of the best woods there is to burn, period.
Lodgepole pine?
Yes, lodgepole pine.
No, is that at a what, 4,000 feet? Where do you get lodgepole?
It's a secret I can't
tell. Another secret. All these secrets.
It's in Trinity County.
Yes, and there's some in Hayfork, and there's some in...
Up around Mount Lassen, there's some up around Mount Shasta. There's lots of
Lodgepole. Now, why is it so great? Is it just it burns clean? Or?
Yeah, it burns clean.
Okay.
Yeah. And it doesn't have the oils in it that irritate you.
So ponderosa or knob cone or some of our low-elevation pines are going to just be full of just as much junk as the oak, probably?
Yes, they have lots of resins, and most of the other pines and stuff have lots of ashes. Put creosote into your chimney and stuff.
Okay.
But the reason I burn manzanita is because it doesn't have that creosote.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that all the things you're taught along the way, like, oh, manzanita burns too hot, it'll just completely, you know, destroy your wood stove.
That's because people don't think before they put it in there. You don't put about four or five pieces in. You put one piece in.
Okay, see how important you are? I would have put in four or five pieces.
Anyway, was there anything else about fire outside? Oh, we wanted to talk about our tribal stuff.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about that the Wintu people are traditionally a matriarchal society, and that the women were, we didn't have anybody called a chief. They were the headmen or the headwomen, and that we would have the spokesman, and he may be called traditionally the headman of the tribe, and today they might call him a chief. We have Walt Loomis, who is descendant of our last male chief over in Trinity County, but right now Marilyn Delgado is our tribal chair. And she's the one that goes to Washington. She's the one that finds about grants and that kind of stuff. And she is our tribal leader right now. She was voted in because of who she was as a person, and she thought we could help our tribe. So you earn your right to be a tribal chair. It's not given to you.
Ted, you've obviously taken a keen interest in preserving your heritage. Is that something that's unique among the Wintu or Native American people today, or is there a resurgence, revitalization of people being interested in their past, or is it kind of people swimming upstream, so to speak?
Unfortunately, a lot of Indian people have gotten into eating food that is not good for them, and they have allergies, and they've turned to getting diabetes. We didn't have diabetics before because of the food we ate. We ate only wild game and fresh food. And I could talk for hours on this subject, so I need to be careful.
You know what? Eric just wrote a little note to me, and he said, you know, have you explained really where the Wintu are, what counties, and, you know, like your geographic location?
Okay. There have always been land disputes and boundary disputes as long as the Indians have been here. what's interesting, and I'll be real short with this one, the designation between the Pitt River tribe, which is east of Redding, and the Wintu tribe, which is on the other side of the Sacramento River, there's a ley line between Mount Shasta and Mount Lassen. On the west of that's Wintu land. On the east of that is Pitt River land. But they move cross back and forth, and they like to irritate each other, so they do that.
Oh, good.
I'm Narelmuk. Traditionally, I have a map, and I'm not going to sit there and argue with people about boundaries because I want to get along with each other. Traditionally, the Narelmuk boundaries were west of the Sacramento River, all the way over to, like, the Hoopa area, over to Higham Palm, Hay Fork. The Wintu, the Narelmuk Wintu came from Hay Fork and Higham Palm. I'm Namsus, which is from Junction City area in Trinity County. But because of our territory, I decided I wanted to be a Narelmuk, which by territory, that's our territory for the Narelmuks. The Winnemem were up the Sacramento, or up the McLeod River. That was their traditional grounds. There's nine bands of the Wintu people. There's the Bald Hills Wintu people that were southeast of Redding. And Gary Rickards, who was a tribal chair at one time, and his sister came from there. I'm told I'm supposed to stop. Anyway,
you know how radio is. We love the information, but we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back. This is Positively Healthy. Well, welcome back. You're listening to Positively Healthy here on KCNR, and I'm Dr. Trudy Pratt. And in the studio today, we have Ted Dawson, our primitive skills teacher from the area. Maybe your kids or maybe you have had taken a class from Ted. These are things that he does around our area. And during the break, we were talking about, you know, acorns and acorn mash, mush? What
mush.
Is it? Mush. Okay, so, you know, I've always wanted to try it. I think we tried it when we were in Campfire Girls or something. And, you know, at that age, who really would... You know, it was just that was just a little too different for our brains. But I would have to think that it's certainly something I'd love to try now. So tell us how you make that and what's the benefit.
It's probably a secret.
It's a secret. That's right. Another secret.
You can eat any of the acorns. I'll tell you the best acorn because
yeah.
I'm nice. Black oak acorns have the best flavor of all of the acorns.
Okay.
I don't know where any of those are, though.
They're in his yard, I can tell.
Yeah, they are in my yard. Up in Shingletown.
In
you
Shingletown.
Know where Shingletown is?
No.
Anyway, take the acorns, and what's the interesting about acorns? Acorn is a true nut. Peanuts are not nuts. They're a legume, and most people don't realize that an acorn is a true nut. Anyway, an acorn is one of the most incredible full foods, and... When you grind the acorns, the more you powder it up, the better you get the tannic acid out of there. But when I make it for myself, I'll smash it until they're just small pebbles. And then I'll put it in my creek in a bag and leave it there for about a day or so. I'll take it out, dry it, and then I'll finally powder it up into real fine powder. And then I'll decide whether I'm going to make some ash cakes with it, which means you take ashes from the fire and mix it with the acorns, and you can make a bread with it. It's a flat bread, and a lot of people don't like it because it's just not that tasty or flat. It's not like bread that we think of. Anyway, you cook it on a rock, and it comes out really, really tasty as far as I'm concerned. But anyway, after you leach the tannic acid out of the acorns, and you make soup out of it, you still want to powder it up. And I like a more watery soup, and a lot of people like the mush. If you make it a little more watery, it actually is easier to take. It's tastier. And what I put in there, here's the secret.
I know.
I'll
We're
put,
writing.
I'll put some sea kelp in there to flavor it a little bit. And I'll take a bay leaf, and I'll put it in there. California Bay Laurel leaf to put it in there, and that'll give it a little better flavor also. there's some acorns, like down here at the Anderson River, or not Anderson River, the where the swimming pool is. There's an oak tree down there where you can literally take the acorns and eat them off the ground. I don't know which tree that is, though.
Of course not. I can tell a lot of knowledge is going to the grave with you. You're not sharing much. Mark, go ahead.
Ted, 150 years ago, before European settlers came here, there were Indians living all along the Sacramento River. Could you describe, to the best of your understanding, what their diet was?
Acorns. And fish.
Acorns and fish and roots,
well,
perhaps, right?
Yeah, there were lots of stuff, but acorns was the staple, and they would go out and just get hordes of it. And a family may own a tree, and if your tree doesn't have any acorns, because they take turns every other year or two, oak trees take turns and go dormant for a year. And if your tree didn't have it, you would go to their family and say, my family needs acorns. And you would all pick together. It was a family thing. It was a social thing. It was something where people got together, or the women got together. Women did not kill. Women were there to process food, but women bring life in. They bring babies. They bring life. They don't take life. So I have a bow that I've killed with, and I won't take it out because a woman might want to touch it, and that would contaminate it as far as I'm concerned.
Suddenly we're quiet in the studio. Oh, okay. I can't touch it. Okay.
You bring life.
I bring life, okay.
You mentioned the diet that many latter-day Native Americans have now, and I know I was at the Rancheria a few months ago at a luncheon. It was for the diabetic group there. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, how this has happened, how you've gone from being fairly healthy race to such an unhealthy subgroup?
People, the Europeans brought wheat and flour to the Indians because they wanted them to be civilized. Well, wheat and flour, it's toxic to many, many people. And that one thing has brought an awful lot of unhealthy stuff to the people. Fry bread is one of the worst things you could eat. I don't eat fry bread. I will politely, and I will be polite about it, but I suggest that if you go to the powwows or anything, don't eat fry bread. It's not good for you. It really isn't.
Yeah.
It changes the sugar level in your body. It changes the insulin level. And when your pancreas gets altered like that because you're eating flour, you can get sick. There's a plant called yacón. It's from Peru. It will change the balance and help your pancreas and the rest of your body balance out the sugar levels.
How hard do you think it is to really get that message across to Native Americans that flour or white sugar, white flour are so devastating to their health?
Well, I'm 60 years old, and most people even half my age can't even keep up with me because I don't eat very much flour. I don't eat very much sugar. I don't use hardly any salt in my food. So I'm a living example of what you can do when you don't abuse your body. And as far as I'm concerned, eating all those white things is abuse to your body. And I love pastries. I had a donut the other day, and it was really, really good. But I had to pay for it.
Yeah. So then part of the message you would like to pass on then is about choice. Like you love it, but you're choosing not to not have it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's.
But you're also,
that's huge.
You're also suggesting that Native Americans, because of their food history, they're genetically predisposed to allergies for wheat and flour,
yes,
which Europeans got used to, perhaps, yeah, over.
Europeans have a whole lot of problem here too. This is not. This is just not one group.
I mean, like our diet is one of the biggest things we can control. I mean, like we have choices. Now that it's springtime, we can eat fresh veggies. eat lots of fresh green veggies.
Mm-hmm. How wonderful. Gosh. Well, you know, we're coming to the end of our show, and I want to be able to make sure you can find Ted here. I'm going to give you his phone number, which is 474-3257. And then once again, his email address is win2knives@frontiernet.net. So he's pretty easy to find. So catch us next week, same time, same station. This is Dr. Trudy Pratt. Thanks for listening today. Goodbye.